Support for WPR comes from Monk Botanical Gardens in Wausau, hosting Blossom of Lights, an after-dark stroll through illuminated gardens, Wednesdays to Saturdays, mid-September through October. Blossomoflights.org.
Support for WPR comes from Worm Farm Institute with the Farm Art Detour, a self-guided excursion through 50 miles of scenic farmland in rural Sauk County, October 5th through the 14th. WormFarmInstitute.org.
It's Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. The Food and Drug Administration recently approved a request from Florida to allow mass prescription drug imports from Canada. Canadian drug prices are far cheaper than the prices we see here in the U.S., and advocates say this could cut costs for patients moving forward. Pharmaceutical companies oppose the plan. Wisconsin is one of eight other states with laws in place that allow for a state drug importation program, though it's unclear if and when state officials are planning to seek FDA approval. The Florida decision has ignited fierce debate and discussions over whether this will be a step toward forward in the effort to corral drug prices in the U.S., and the implications could be significant. We want to hear what you think about all of this at 800-642-1234. Do you or your family struggle to pay for necessary prescriptions? Is lowering prescription drug prices an important issue for you politically? Will it factor into who you vote for in the general election this year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Christina Jewett is a journalist at the New York Times, where she covers the Food and Drug Administration. Christina, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Shereen. Appreciate it.
And Kevin Look is an associate professor in the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison. Kevin, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks for the opportunity to join you today.
Well, I'm happy to have you both here. Christina, you broke this story for the New York Times, and in some ways, it's been brewing for years. Why Florida, and why now?
Well, Governor DeSantis saw an opportunity. This is something that had been just, sitting for decades. There was a law that said, the U.S. can import drugs from Canada that was passed in 2004. And that just sat on the books forever until President Trump sort of kicked it forward. President Biden gave it one last nudge, and it basically, became possible to do this. And President Biden urged the FDA to work with states. And Florida, was the first to jump in line, had the best, most developed proposal. And Governor DeSantis actually sued the FDA, accusing them of dragging their feet on the application, and was poised to, basically a judge said the FDA has to make a decision. So the FDA decided and granted their application, and that brought us to this latest little bit of news.
Christina, you said that there was a lawsuit involved, that Governor DeSantis really wanted this to move forward. Was this a long process? How long did it take?
I want to say not that long in FDA years.
In dog years?
Which is kind of like dog years. Yeah, it was like half a dog year, truly. So short for FDA, just, I think 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. But, long for a governor who wants to, show the residents of Florida that he can really, help them with their bottom line.
That's interesting. Kevin, Wisconsin is one of a few states that already has laws in the books that would allow this kind of state drug importation program. What would a program like this look like in Wisconsin?
Well, I think our program would look quite similar, I think, to what the Florida program is. And really the devil's in the details, where if you look at the proposal that was submitted by Florida and eventually approved by the FDA, it's actually very restrictive in nature. It really only applies to the Florida Medicaid program, providing care for the lowest income individuals in the state and some of the highest need for prescription drugs, as well as a couple of other, state government level programs. It really is not intended at this stage to have a broader impact on sort of the average Floridian's drug costs. I think this mirrors what President Biden was trying to do with the Inflation Reduction Act, really targeting the federal Medicare program. I think what we would see in Wisconsin would be very similar, starting with Medicaid or prisons, corrections, tribal health, really with those government programs. And then the hope would be that you could eventually expand that to the broader public.
So, Kevin, knowing that Wisconsin has the laws in the books for this kind of program, is the infrastructure basically in place that Wisconsin could move forward with this if they wanted to?
That's a great question, and I think there really has not been a ton of movement on this. I think in part because, as was pointed out in the article, really there has not been a lot of movement on this. There's been a number of states who've submitted proposals or who have started proposals, but really it didn't seem realistic until now. So I think this sort of, as Christina pointed out, Florida really was ahead of the game. They already have some companies identified that could help with the importation process. They have some procedures put in place. They've already invested a significant amount of money into this initiative. I think Wisconsin has sort of some structure and some ideas, but I don't think it's quite ready to, say, go live tomorrow or anything like that. I think there would still be some time to flesh it out a little bit more. And I think now the Florida proposal would sort of be used as a benchmark or a framework for any other state that was interested in pursuing this.
Christina, I'm curious whether this has kind of eased the way for other states like Wisconsin to implement their own drug importation program. Do you feel like what's happened here is going to – there's going to be a domino effect, or are there some significant barriers yet that have to be overcome?
Well, ultimately, it remains to be seen, but there are barriers that are being talked about already. One being the pharmaceutical industry lobby already sued over this, and a judge basically said, you know, there hasn't been like a dollar spent on drugs imported from Canada yet, so you don't have standing to sue. So once that, you know, the product starts flowing, the money starts changing hands, I mean, then that changes, and does pharma sue? At that point, I think there's a broad expectation that that happens. The other sort of tricky thing that came up was Colorado wrote a report to the health department, wrote a report to their legislature. This was news that KFF Health News broke. And basically Colorado officials were like, nobody's returning our calls. Like, we're trying to, you know, talk to people in Canada to get this going, but like we're just being totally locked out, and that their understanding is that there are some contractual terms between drug makers and the companies that actually load up trucks and transport drugs, you know, around Canada and potentially to the U.S., that there's some contractual language that says you can't take our product from Canada to the U.S. So that sort of seems like it bodes a little poorly for other states that are really trying to get this going. So, I mean, it ultimately, like I said, remains to be seen, but there are some signs that it may not be as easy for others as it was for Florida, which wasn't that easy anyway.
Well, that sounds like it. Christina, what does the law say now about individuals buying drugs directly from Canadian pharmacies? Does the law say we can do that now as a – can I just order a drug from Canadian pharmacy?
Yeah, that is currently legal. I don't know a whole lot more than that, how practical or feasible or frequent it is. I wish I had more expertise there, but my understanding is that currently is the law.
Okay. Kevin, can you talk a little bit about some of the factors that go into how much a prescription drug costs for patients?
How much time you got? Simple question with a very long, difficult, complex answer. I mean, certainly it starts with drug manufacturers setting prices that they feel are fair, that the market can bear. You know, they like to say it's based on the cost of things like research and development, but there's research to show that the R&D costs of a drug really don't matter when it comes to determining what the cost of a drug is. But, you know, so manufacturers are involved depending on how much it costs to develop or produce a drug. We often have insurance companies that are involved. Really, when we talk about prescription drugs, we're talking about pharmacy benefit managers. They're an intermediary that sort of administer drug benefits. And so, you know, when you go and get your insurance card, you often have health insurance that covers your healthcare needs, and then you often have a drug insurance card through some sort of pharmacy benefit manager. And there's a lot of talk of them inflating costs and really contributing to high prescription drug prices because of some of their business practices. The manufacturers and the PBMs like to point fingers at each other. Certainly, there are healthcare providers and pharmacies that, you know, we live in a for-profit healthcare system, so everyone sort of wants a little bit of a piece of the pie. And there's several other smaller intermediaries involved, but, you know, there's a lot of, I think one of the biggest issues when it comes to drug prices is there's a complete lack of transparency. We don't know exactly how much it costs to develop a drug. We don't know exactly how much it costs to produce that drug once it's been developed. We don't know how much it costs a pharmacy to buy that drug or how much they're selling it for, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of other hidden costs that are sort of more than I could probably take on right now, but we have manufacturers working with the health insurers and the drug insurers to come up with rebates or discounts. So there's a lot of hidden things that are happening. A lot of times this is hidden information. So it's really complex. It's really challenging because we just don't know a lot of the information we need.
Kevin Look is an associate professor in the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison, and Christina Jewett covers the Food and Drug Administration for the New York Times. We're talking about the recent news that the FDA is allowing Florida to import prescription drugs from Canada and what that could mean for reducing drug prices in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you be in favor of Wisconsin importing medicine from Canada to reduce prices? Or do you have concerns about the safety, the effectiveness, the sustainability of a drug importation program? What other solutions do you think policymakers should be considering to make medicine more affordable? Call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about what a state drug importation program could mean for prescription drug prices in Wisconsin and throughout the country. And we want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones. We have Nancy with us now from Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy. Thanks for calling.
Hello, hello. My endocrinologist wants me to have a drug for advanced osteoporosis. I am 92 years old. This can only be given as a drip in the arm, not by mouth. When I found out that on that list of 10 drugs that Biden is going to make available this year, supposedly at a lower cost, not one of those drugs is for this condition, osteoporosis. I am very angry about this, because at least 65% of all Congress members are at least 65 years old. And most of them probably are either already have osteoporosis or osteopenia, which is the beginning of the porosis part of it. And you can damn well bet they're not going to be paying the $1,000 that I have to pay because this drug is not covered by insurance, not by any insurance.
Yeah, Nancy, thanks for that, and I'm sorry to hear that. Christina, you can hear the frustration in Nancy's voice. I mean, do you feel like this is something that will really help people like Nancy who are struggling with the cost of these medications?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, Medicare's decision making, it got, you know, kind of technical kind of fast. Medicare was looking at, you know, what are drugs we spend the most on? So you have drugs that are kind of high in price and, you know, for conditions that affect, you know, many, many, many seniors. So they started with, you know, 10 drugs to sort of kick off the process. And there was also some rules around how long the drugs had been on the market. So you can imagine that sort of limits the pool to, you know, not that many drugs. So I think that was the challenge there in terms of really helping like the broadest swath of seniors. So yeah, that is definitely a challenge. I mean, I think, you know, it's possible in years to come, things change, but right now the IRA is being pretty heavily challenged, in court by the drug companies. So that's also, you know, moving forward mm-hmm. with sort of all of those sort of caveats in mind.
So let's go to the phone. We have Chris with us now from Mineral Point. Thanks for calling, Chris.
Hi. I used to live in El Paso, and a lot of people, a lot of doctors and vets would recommend people fill their prescriptions in Mexico because the prescription drugs cost so much less. Why has Mexico not been considered for something like this also?
That's a good question. Thanks, Chris. I'm not sure which one of you would be best to answer that. Kevin, do you know?
Yeah, so, you know, the biggest concerns or pushback against drug importation has to do around safety and the ability to really know that the drug you're receiving is of the same quality as what we would get here in the U.S. And I think people are a lot more comfortable with Canada than they are with Mexico, in part because, you know, it's another developed country that has a lot of similarities to the U.S. I think people have a higher level of trust that the medications they would be getting from Canada are, you know, not tampered with in any way. They're exactly what it says on the bottle and things like that. I think there's more concerns about the ability to do that in Mexico, but realistically, you know, the idea could be expanding this to other countries in the future, but the biggest pushback, even the biggest concerns expressed in the FDA's decisions have to do with if Florida's going to be doing this, they have to make absolutely sure that the drugs are what they're supposed to be and that no one's messing with those or that, you know, they're being diluted along the way or something like that, because that would be absolutely horrible for people to experience that here in the U.S.
Christina, what kind of testing does the FDA do to make sure that drugs imported from Canada are safe and effective? Is there anything like that underway?
Yeah, you know, those rules are all going to be imposed on the states, but they do expect them to test. They do expect them to set up a system where if there's a drug recall, Florida can, you know, make sure that those drugs from Canada, you know, get recalled. If a consumer has a complaint that a drug is causing an unexpected side effect, that all of that, you know, information gets to the right place. So there are a lot of layers that the states are expected to sort of pick up that the FDA usually takes care of. And actually for that reason, this is kind of a side note, some people are questioning whether the cost savings that we expect will actually, you know, be delivered, because those sort of like pieces are expensive to set up to, you know, really ensure the safety effectiveness of the drugs and make sure that if anything's sort of going wrong, it is addressed, you know, in the same way that the federal government would handle it.
A nursing student from Eau Claire called in. This is a great question. The nursing student said, there are more medications approved for use in Canada than in the United States. Could the U.S. import those, or is this restricted to what's been approved already in the U.S.? Christina, do you know?
You know, we spent some time kicking at this question, and I have to say I'm not 100% sure. One of the requirements is that a U.S. label is put on the medication when it goes from Canada to, you know, consumers in the U.S. So I imagine if there is no U.S. label, you might, you know, run into a problem real fast. But I have to confess, I haven't read all the fine print of the regulations. But our impression was, you know, to get that label on there, you had to have something that exists in the same form in the U.S. But, you know, that being said, the pharmaceutical manufacturers did sort of raise this as a problem, and we sort of pressed them and didn't get like a really specific sense of their, you know, their concern of how non-approved drugs might get into the U.S. So I'm sorry that's not as satisfying of an answer as I wish I had. But, you know, I think this is going to be very closely watched, and that's certainly a question that we'll be continuing to ask.
Yeah, interesting question. We got an email from Jim in Cedarburg who asked, please tell me the difference in the final cost when a drug is researched by a university versus a pharmaceutical. Kevin, do you know? Does that make a difference?
At the end of the day, it does not make a difference, which I think also makes people very unhappy. I think there's been some discussions under the Biden administration of trying to recoup some of the money that the National Institutes of Health are spending at places like UW-Madison and elsewhere around the country, you know, to research new drugs. A private pharmaceutical company buys the rights or the patents to those drugs, and then they essentially can do whatever they want with it. And there's really not a lot of cost savings to the federal government after that fact. So I think there's starting to be some pushback and some momentum on that. But frankly, a lot of really innovative new drugs are discovered or developed in using NIH dollars, but we don't necessarily see any impact on the final cost of that drug to consumers.
Christina, we've got about 30 seconds left in our time together. What are you watching for next in this story? What is the next element going to be here?
I mean, the questions are, you know, does the product start moving and when? There are a lot of boxes to check and sort of red tape to deal with for this to start happening. So I think that's, you know, question number one is, can this get done? And the approval is actually only for 2 years. And by that 2 years, Florida has to prove to the FDA that A, they're delivering a cost saving to consumers, and B, that the product they're importing is, you know, is safe. So those are the big things. Does it happen and does it work?
We'll be watching. Thank you so much for joining us, Christina. This has been fascinating. Great reporting.
Thank you. We really appreciate being here.
Christina Jewett is an investigative journalist at the New York Times, where she covers the Food and Drug Administration. And Kevin, thank you for being here today as well.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Kevin Look is an associate professor in the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison. They were here with us for a look at the FDA's recent authorization for Florida to import medicine from Canada and what role state importation programs could play in broader efforts to reduce drug prices around the country. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. Now, on Tuesday, the Wisconsin State Senate voted to reject one of Governor Tony Evers' appointments to the Public Service Commission, which regulates utilities in the state. It's the latest in a line of Evers' appointees rejected by the Senate over the last 6 months. A state capitol reporter is here to help us break down why Wisconsin Republicans decided to vote Commissioner Tyler Huebner out of his position. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about these appointments? What do you think about the recent string of rejections by the state Senate? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Andrew Ball is a reporter covering state government for the Cap Times. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What is the Public Service Commission? We hear about it, but what exactly are they responsible for?
Yeah, so they regulate utilities in Wisconsin of all stripes, and they'll hear a wide range of cases. You'll probably hear them most in the news when they decide whether utilities should be able to raise rates, but you know, they handle a wide range of other things, as the case of Commissioner Huebner, I think, kind of shed some light on.
Yes. And I'm curious what kinds of qualifications commissioners generally have in this role. Are they professionals with a lot of experience in the utility sector?
Yeah, generally, yes. And you'll see kind of different backgrounds. Commissioner Huebner himself used to work. He was the executive director of Renew Wisconsin, which is a nonprofit that supports renewable energy. He also worked with the U.S. Department of Energy and kind of other renewable energy related positions. And that's not uncommon. You'll see another commissioner background in an engineering construction firm. So, you know, they know their way around the utility sector by and large.
How long had he been in this position?
Yeah, so it's a little convoluted, but he was first appointed in 2020 to fill out the remainder of a term by a commissioner appointed by Governor Scott Walker, and then Governor Tony Evers, Walker's Democratic successor, nominated him for a full term in 2021, and the Senate is just now getting around to taking it up.
Was there any hint that his tenure was controversial in any way? I guess, in other words, was this a surprise?
Yeah. So back in September during his confirmation hearing, there were different things that were raised that showed some friction between the commissioner and Republican legislators. One that was mentioned on the floor by Senator Julian Bradley, a Republican from Franklin, on Tuesday when the full Senate voted on his confirmation, was the Public Service Commission's vote on a Madison idea, a pilot program to offer people rebates, basically, based off their income to help them with their water bills. And I think Republican legislators argued that state statute doesn't allow them to do this. The legality was never really brought up with the PSC, but that's one area of tension. Also, whether solar developers should be allowed to lease to customers on projects, that is kind of up in the air on whether that's allowed, kind of in dispute. And then a few other things, requiring utilities to report diversity, demographic information. There were definitely some signs that they weren't happy with some different decisions. It was civil, but, you know, some tension.
How was it then that the Senate was able to fire him? How does this work? I mean, are they able to just fire any appointee at any time? What goes on there?
Yeah, so the language is that the governor can make appointments with the advice and consent of the Senate. And it feels a little weird because in some cases the Senate might not get around to the appointments for months or even years, which is the case for these commissioners. But they are allowed to vote on whether or not these people should be appointed. And it has been a subject of friction between Governor Evers and the Senate because this is not the first time
right.
that one of his appointments has been voted down. But definitely a trend that we're seeing.
How has the governor reacted, Andrew, to this pattern of his appointees being rejected?
He has perhaps predictably not been real happy. he has basically said that Republicans are doing this for political reasons. Now, the Republicans themselves say that they feel that when they voted appointments down, it's been for good reason. And they point to the fact that, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of Evers' other appointments have been approved. But the governor has been saying that, you know, it's been harder and harder to find people willing to fill these kinds of public service positions, even being agency secretaries, knowing that they're going to have to go through this confirmation process.
That's interesting. I'm curious about public sentiment, too. I mean, in your reporting, have you talked to people? Do you have a sense of how the general public reacts to these kinds of rejections? Do they think it's okay, or is there some skepticism?
It's a really interesting question. I haven't directly asked members of the public. I'm a little worried that if I did, the first response people would have is, what is the Public Service Commission?
Yeah.
But I will say one thing that was expressed on the floor by Democrats who were worried about Commissioner Huebner getting voted down is they pointed to support from his colleagues in the regulatory agencies in other states. And they also pointed to his experience on renewable energy issues specifically, and that is a really good fit for Wisconsin right now, you know, having to kind of grapple with an energy portfolio that leans more heavily on renewables. And, you know, that there is, you know, there are definitely groups speaking out saying that they wanted the commissioner to remain in his position.
So put this in context for us then. What's the state of the Public Service Commission at this point? I mean, is it just business as usual?
Yeah, so it's actually it's been an interesting week for the PSC. One of Eber's other appointments, Commissioner Summer Strand, was actually approved on a bipartisan vote minutes after they voted down Commissioner Huebner. But last week, the chair of the PSC, Rebecca Valk, announced that she would be stepping down in February and that, you know, the governor has not announced who he's going to appoint to replace her. Summer Strand will be the chair, but there will be a third seat that's not filled. We do know that the governor has put forward a top staffer on the PSC to fill Commissioner Huebner's seat, with the idea being that that will help kind of maintain continuity and prevent any delays on the important issues before the PSC.
What do you know about the replacement that Evers appointed? What do you know about Summer Strand?
You know, it is an interesting contrast that I believe the vote was 27-5 in favor of confirming Summer Strand at the same time as the commissioner was voted down. As for Commissioner Huebner's replacement, she is kind of a top administrative staffer, so clearly knows her way around these issues. And again, you know, the governor was stressing that the hope is that this will keep things running smoothly at the PSC, but, you know, it is probably something that folks interested in how much they're paying on their utilities and who are interested in, you know, environmental issues probably want to be keeping an eye on going forward.
Well, it's an interesting situation, and we'll be watching your reporting moving forward. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Ball is a reporter covering state government for the Cap Times. We talked with him about why the Wisconsin State Senate voted to reject Governor Tony Evers' appointment to the Public Service Commission. Coming up, we'll dig into what the firing says about the state of our divided government. And we want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. Weigh in. Are you happy with the state Senate's decision to vote out the Public Service Commissioner? Do you think the Senate's majority is overstepping by rejecting so many appointments, or is this the way it should be done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk about the Wisconsin State Senate voting to fire Tyler Huebner, Governor Tony Evers' appointment to the Public Service Commission, and what that says about divisions in our state government. We'd love to hear what you think as well at 800-642-1234. What changes would you like to see in how Wisconsin Democrats and Republicans govern together? What questions do you have about the appointment process? And what would you consider a good reason for the Senate to reject or fire an appointee? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Mordecai Lee is a professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee and a former state legislator. Mordecai, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Tell us how gubernatorial appointments work. What is their purpose, and what does that approval process look like?
Well, I think most people probably remember from sort of high school civics that there are a lot of major offices where the president or the governor nominates somebody to a major office, and then it's up to the Senate, the upper house of the legislative branch, to either confirm or deny them. I mean, most people remember big fights over, let's say, Supreme Court appointments. But generally speaking, these aren't that controversial. It's the president saying or the governor saying, I would like this person to be part of my team, and I'm asking the in this case, the state Senate or the U.S. Senate, to please confirm my appointment. And so that's, I guess you'd call it the traditional approach in government. It's longstanding. Sometimes there would be appointments that would be confirmed within days of being nominated. So what's happening now in the last couple of years in the state Senate is very unusual. It's a real break from the past.
So this is not historically what we've seen. How common are rejected appointments, both here and on the federal level as well?
It's relatively uncommon. In other words, that members of a U.S. Senate or the state Senate, generally speaking, have an understanding that a governor or a president has a right to appoint his or her team. And when you have a legislative body controlled by one party and the president or the governor controlled by the other party, you can assume that there'd be some disagreements. But the way the current Republican majority of the state Senate is handling it is a real break from the past. It's very, very different. They've really found a crack in the Constitution that really nobody ever thought of before. And what they've been doing in the last few years is legal and constitutional, but it really changes the game in terms of the powers of the governor and the powers of the state Senate.
Huebner was unconfirmed for a whole year before this happened. What was the intention behind that?
You know, this is where the shrewd tactic that the Republican Senate came up with is occurring. In other words, under the tradition of what we talked about earlier, when the state Senate or U.S. Senate votes on a nomination, it's prospective. In other words, it's the governor or the president saying, here's a person I'd like to hold that office, and then the state Senate or U.S. Senate votes on it. In other words, they really have no idea what that person will do once in office. And they judge the person by their background, their character, whatever it might be. But they have no idea how that person would actually conduct herself or himself in office. What the state, a Republican state senators discovered was that they can just sit on a nomination. In other words, just as you described it, somebody could hold office for a year. Somebody could hold office for 2, 3, 4 years, and they would decline to vote on it. And then, if they wanted to, they could bring it up. So, on the one hand, state law says that once the governor nominates somebody to an office, if that office is vacant, the person can immediately take office. And so then let's say the state Senate does not act on their appointment for a month, for 6 months, for a year, for 2 years. Then if they suddenly bring it up, what they're doing is they're not voting on the prospective service of that nominee. They're voting on the person's record. In other words, they're turning the process upside down. They're saying, well, we liked what you decided in such and such a policy, or we didn't like what you decided. And so then it becomes almost like a vote of no confidence. For people who sort of remember a little bit about parliamentary democracy, it might be France, might be Great Britain, where there might be a motion of no confidence in the government. What happened in the state Senate a couple of days ago was tantamount to a vote of no confidence in this one appointee based on his record. And so they were able to vote on the confirmation and deny the confirmation. So that's a very powerful tool, a very powerful tactic.
Well, yeah, what you're describing sounds like a trial run almost, like giving somebody a trial run.
You've really got it. And the thing that I think is so interesting is that to a certain extent, it's the state Senate, the conservative Republican state Senate, saying the governor can only nominate somebody who we like. Now, if somebody is holding office waiting for their confirmation vote, invariably they'll take votes that perhaps a ideological conservative would not like. And so it seems to me that this process that they've invented almost delegitimizes the governor. It's almost like saying to the governor, don't even bother sending us nominations of people who we know we're not going to like. And in fact, we don't want you to nominate somebody who you like. We will only approve somebody who we like. And so it's almost like negating an election. It's negating the reflex that a governor or president has the presumption of putting together their own team. And so I think this is quite radical. It's legal. It's constitutional. But it really changes things. After all, when Tommy Thompson was the Republican governor and the state senate at the time was Democratic, this didn't happen. There was no kind of sense of we get the last word and we're going to drum people out. This is a new development, and I don't think it's all that healthy for sort of, I guess you call it, the comity of how government should be governed.
We have Jimmy on the line with us from Valley Junction. Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for calling.
Afternoon, folks. Yeah, I think this is just sour grapes from Scotty Walker losing to Evers because it seems to me they changed some laws right before Evers took office to hamstring him on some duties, and now they slow walk these nominations. I think there should be something in place that if they don't act upon a nomination within a certain amount of time, it automatically takes effect. And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right, thanks, Jimmy. Mordecai, what do you think about what Jimmy said? Should there be some mechanism in place here?
I mean, to a certain extent, what Jimmy described is a kind of a de facto situation. In other words, once somebody is nominated by the governor, they take office right away. Although their title, instead of, let's say, secretary of the department of such and such, it's secretary designate of the department. And they can hang on for a year, for 2 years, for 3 years. So that's sort of what Jimmy was describing, except for the exercise of finally taking a vote on the confirmation and voting the nomination down. So that really is a difference. I think Jimmy's overall perspective to a certain extent is that Republicans are a lot tougher than Democrats. In other words, Democrats had the option to do this when Tommy was governor. They didn't do it. But Republicans have found these cracks in the Constitution, or based on Jimmy's other recollection, voting to limit a governor's powers and an attorney general's powers just before Tony Evers took office.
Mike is with us on the line from Singer. Mike, thanks for calling. What's your question?
Sure. Yeah, it seems to me that by denying the governor and his appointees, they're also denying the people of Wisconsin their vote. I mean, they voted Democratic because they wanted a Democratic administration to run the state. And he's being denied, essentially denying the will of the people. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. What do you think about what Mike said, Mordecai?
Well, you know, we learned in high school civics about checks and balances in the American constitutional system. And so that's why I was emphasizing that what the state Senate has been doing is legal and constitutional. It's just that it changes the dynamic. It turns it upside down in terms of sort of who gets to have the last word and to be able to prevent the governor from having the appointees that he wants for his term of office. So is it saying that Republicans believe that Tony Evers is an illegitimate president or a delegitimate president and that they've found a way to undermine him? I think to a certain extent that's sort of what's being conveyed, although, of course, they've never said it outright. But we have to link this to what happened to the DNR last year. I think some of your listeners would remember that there was a DNR board member who had been appointed by, I think it was Scott Walker. His term expired, and he was able to stay in office because the state Senate declined to vote on the nomination that Tony Evers made to replace that person. And this was a big fight. It went to the state Supreme Court. The court ruled that as long as that person with the expired office remains in office, that there's no way to force them out. And so that was another very effective tactic that I think the Republican majority came up with. Now, of course, it turned on them when the same thing happened in the Elections Commission.
We have about a minute left together. I know our time is getting short, but I really want your thoughts. When you're looking at the big picture, what does this case say about the condition of our democracy at the state level?
I think what it says is that it's like war. In other words, all's fair in love and war. That in this case, a Republican majority in the state Senate believes that any tactic whatsoever to undermine the governor is fair and should be exercised. And I really think we need to get back to some degree of We're sort of all in this together. We want the government to function, to work. Let's work together. It's like the sense of that we're all in the same boat has totally disappeared. It's two different boats rowing in opposite directions.
Mordecai, I want to thank you for joining us today. This has been a fascinating discussion.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Mordecai Lee is a professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee and a former state legislator. He was with us to talk about why the Wisconsin State Senate voted to fire Governor Tony Evers' appointment to the Public Service Commission and what it says about divisions in our state government. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, a podcast workshop underway at Dane County Juvenile Detention Center helps justice-involved teens envision a better future and learn some new audio production skills. Hear about the program called Making Justice After 7. Earlier this month in Kentucky, the state's tourism board started a new advertising campaign with an unusual target audience. The Lexington Convention and Visitors Bureau is now inviting UFOs and aliens to visit the state to explore Kentucky's beautiful countryside and, of course, its bourbon. The idea for the campaign came from recent UFO revelations and advances in deep space imaging that have fueled this belief that we're not alone in the universe. So personally, I have to say I like the idea, and I think Wisconsin should follow suit. What better than cheese, beer, and bratwurst to lure alien visitors to our planet, right? The only downside, it could take a while to get an answer. The FAA says it'll take 40 years for the message to get to its intended target and another 40 to receive a response, but I think it's worth a try. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. Now, your earliest memory can be difficult to determine, or not. Maybe some of you have yours clearly visualized and stored away with easy access. Some of those memories can be truly happy, if not hazy, while others can certainly be painful to recall. In our next conversation, we're going to hear Rob talk about first memories and how exploring them can stir up some profound thoughts about who we are, who our parents are or were, and the lives we've lived. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your earliest memory? Have you tried to think of it before? Is it difficult to come up with that? And how old were you? Do friends, family, or loved ones have great first memories that they've shared with you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll be taking your calls following this interview. Giles Brandreth is a British writer, broadcaster, ex-MP, and TV star. His new podcast, where he talks to famous people about their childhoods and first memories, is called Rosebud. Rob Ferret spoke to him earlier this week.
Now, you've been a lot of things in your life. Why did you want podcaster to be your newest title?
Well, I wanted to be a podcaster because I like to be as modern as tomorrow and with a lot of time for yesterday. And I tell you why I wanted to be a podcaster. I wanted to have conversations that you don't get on television anymore. When I was young, I've been around for a long time, you would get on TV chat shows where people could talk at length. You will remember Dick Cavett. Mm-hmm. And when I was in New York, I was lucky enough to meet him and to go to one of his shows. And he had, I forget who it was, maybe it was James Baldwin, great American writer. He came on and he talked for half an hour or more at length. And it was wonderful to listen to this wise, interesting, controversial man just talking, talking, talking. And I thought, we don't get that now. We live in the age of the soundbite. Everything's done on TikTok in 45, 15 seconds. I want to meet people, and I want to meet interesting people, and I want to spend time with them. And also, when you hear people talking on shows, maybe like some of the ones you do, certainly the ones I do a lot of broadcasting over here for the BBC, and I appear on the TV show in the mornings, we get guests, but they're very rarely on for more than 5, 6, 7 minutes. And they usually talk to us about their latest movie, TV series, their latest book. They're promoting something. And I wanted to spend time with people. And I think to find out what people are like now, maybe we should go back to the beginning and find out what they were like then. So I've started this new podcast, which I have to say I'm very excited about because it seems to be being listened to around the world, with people taking them back to their childhoods. And the question that I ask everybody at the beginning of this podcast, which is called Rosebud, for a reason I'm sure you'll understand, the first question I always ask is, what is your very, very first memory? Not a memory taken from a photograph in a family album, but actually in your head. What can you picture first in your life?
What was the inspiration for that first question? Because it's a amazing first question that certainly got me thinking.
Well, the inspiration, I think, really came from the title. I was thinking one day, it was my father's birthday, and my father died when he was only 71 years of age. He knew he was going to die then because when he was a schoolboy, he went to a fair, a circus, and he met a gypsy fortune teller, a lady who sat in a tent. This is a long time ago. We're talking about the 1920s, 100 years ago. And this lady looked into his palm, and she said, oh, young man, you would live a long life. You're going to die at the age of 71. Well, when you're 17, 71 seems a long way away. But he, all his life, remembered that this gypsy lady had said he was going to die at the age of 71. So sure enough, when he was 71, he died. It didn't help that he smoked. He smoked a great deal, and that may have contributed as well. But I was thinking about him and how, on his birthday, I was thinking about him, and I was thinking about how he used to take me to the movies, and one of his favorite films was Citizen Kane with Orson Welles. And I remember the scene at the end, because I saw it many times. And in the movie theater we went to see it in the days when he took me, you could sit on either side of the movie theater. One side was for smokers, one side was non-smoking. But he was a smoker, so I sat and saw many great movies, like Citizen Kane with Orson Welles, through a haze of smoke. Anyway, I never saw it clearly. But what I do remember is towards the end of the movie, there is this scene where the character that Orson Welles plays, based on, we're led to believe, William Randolph Hearst, where he recollects his mother and seeing his mother for the last time and remembers the sledge that had the trademark Rosebud. And that's what gave me the idea. I thought, oh, yes, I wish I could go back to my father's childhood. What was my father's first memory? Because my first memory is of my father. And it's one of two first memories. I remember standing in the street with him, and I must have been about 2.5 years of age, and it was outside an apartment block, and he was moving furniture into the car. And I think I remember it vividly because I thought he was going away without me, and I was going to lose him. The other recollection I have of him, the first one, but I think this may be recollected later, is I remember the coronation of our late Queen Elizabeth II. Was crowned in 1953, and my father, I know, took me on his shoulders to watch the coronation. And I seem to remember sitting on his shoulders, trying to watch the soldiers marching past through a kind of periscope, a homemade periscope. But I think that may be a memory of an incident he told me about. So what I try to do with my guests is take them back to their very first memory. What is your very first recollection?
Mine, I thought about this in preparing, and here's what I think it is. Weirdly, it has to do with radio. I can remember being in a car with my parents. I don't remember which car. They switched them from time to time. And there were voices, right, on the radio. They listened, I guess, to a talk show. And I remember thinking, how do they get the people in the front of the car to talk to us like that? Are there tiny little people? And I was puzzled and baffled. I kind of remember that. I don't think I remember anything before that. I've worked in radio now for a couple decades. I still haven't figured out how to get the little people in there. But that was the thing that I came up with. I can't think of anything before that.
Well, what is interesting, and I think your listeners, if they listen to our podcast, Rosebud, there will be people that they've heard of, people like the great Dame Judi Dench, our most famous actress.
Michael Palin.
And Michael Palin, the great traveler, the Monty Python hero. So there'll be people that they have heard of, people they won't have heard of, like someone who knew our late queen because she was the lady-in-waiting to Princess Margaret. There'll be other intriguing people. But what is fascinating is if you go to their very first memories, and I almost want to take these to a psychiatrist or an analyst, is often, like you, the first memory seems to almost predict the journey that the person will take. And there you are on radio all these years later. You're like my cat. My cat still goes around the back of the TV set to work out where the people are.
Oh, me too.
You see these things on the front of the TV. They walk around the back. I say that. The cat no longer does that because the TV is on the wall. We've now got a big TV. But you can remember when that was possible. So have you been inviting some of your listeners to recall their first memories?
We are going to do that, and people can call in now at 800-642-1234, and we'll take your calls after we're done talking to Giles. But, Giles, you also invite you talk to the famous people for the most part, but you also invite listeners to share yours. Have you gotten a great response? Are you seeing themes emerge as you get this huge collection of data?
As you will discover in the next few minutes, you do. There are a mixture. People call up or write in with happy recollections because they feel they had a good childhood and their first recollection tends to be something warm. Though what we do on the radio, on our show, our podcast, is we then unpack it. I would say, you know, if I was asking you the next question, I would say to you, who were your parents? Why were you in the back seat? They were in the front seat. Who did the driving? What was your dad like? What was your mum like? We then explore that. But then people also, they call in with recollections often which reflect anxiety. There was a moment when something went wrong. People remember being taken away to a hospital. They remember thinking, am I going to lose one of my parents? Or they recollect the arrival of a sibling, a brother or a sister. They're moments of anxiety that sort of get locked into people's heads. So I think you will be intrigued by the range of recollections. And what we then, some people, begin to explore for themselves, they then think, that's what I remember first. Why do I remember it first? Often people are in high chairs with food. Some people are spreading the food about, flicking it about. Occasionally we've had people remembering their pets, their cats or their dogs. But your parents are usually very much involved. I'd be very intrigued to see what you hear.
And Giles, fantastic. Before I let you go, you mentioned wishing you could do this with your father. Is there a historical figure, someone deceased, who you wished you could have this rosebud conversation with?
Yes, there are so many people that one would be fascinated to hear about. I mean, in the 1960s, when I was first in the United States, it was not long after the assassination of President Kennedy. And I remember I was very lucky. I was a teenager. I was 17, 18 years of age. I went to Washington, D.C., and I was at the Senate. And I didn't realize that the elevators, that one was marked senators only. I didn't see the sign. I stepped into the elevator, and I found I was going up in the elevator with Bobby Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, the younger brother of the president, who was his attorney general. And I traveled up in the elevator. And it's often occurred to me, having read biographies of the Kennedy family, I've heard such stories about their parents. And we in the United Kingdom know quite a bit about President Kennedy's father because he was the ambassador here before the Second World War. And I would love to discover what the childhood of the real childhood of the Kennedy family was like. So I would choose, I think, President John Kennedy to inquire of him about his first childhood recollection and then begin to unpack the nature of his childhood and his life. So that's my choice, President Kennedy.
Giles, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Well, look, can I tell you one more thing?
Sure.
Before you go? Because this might inspire you. There may be somebody out there listening who happened to know the Kennedy family who can call in. But what was intriguing, when I interviewed Judi Dench, the great actress, you may remember her from the James Bond movies and others, wonderful, wonderful actress, she told us about her first boyfriend, because I always ask people about their first boyfriends. And when she was 6 years of age, she recalled that she came out one morning, age six, and her neighbor, a boy who lived in the house next door, was sitting on a wall. And he said to her, Judy, today is the day I think we should start calling each other darling. And I did a show this Christmas with Judy Dench, 84 years after that boy said to her, today's the day we should call each other darling. And they hadn't met for more than 80 years, but I brought this man who was now 90 together with Judy Dench, who is now 89. I brought them together for the first time in more than 80 years. So it may be that you will get people sharing their memories of their childhood, and then you get people getting in touch who haven't seen each other since their childhood. So this is the beginning of a world of exploration. That's what Rosebud has to offer. Delve into the past, discover the present, and who knows what the future will bring.
Amazing. Thanks again for joining us, Giles.
We love Wisconsin Public Radio.
That was Giles Brandreth. He's a British writer, broadcaster, ex-MP, and TV star. Central Time host Rob Ferret talked with him earlier this week about his new podcast. It's called Rosebud. Now it's your turn to share your own story at 800-642-1234. What are some of your earliest memories? Where were you? Who were you with? And have those early memories stuck with you naturally, or have you kind of had to work to recall them? Were there specific sensory details that stand out more than others? And have you reconnected with anyone from your childhood later in life, like Giles was able to facilitate? How'd that go? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. We just heard Rob's conversation with Britain's Giles Brandreth talking about his podcast, Rosebud, where he interviews famous people about their earliest memories. We've got some phone calls already, and I'd like to talk with Bruce from Eau Claire about his memory. Hi, Bruce. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. Yeah, I wanted to tell you about, I grew up on the west side of Madison, and I couldn't have been more than 5 years old, but I was running around in the backyard, and I stepped on a plastic fishing bobber, one of those red and white plastic things, and then the little spring-loaded copper hook penetrated my foot, and it was stuck, and I was trying to figure out, I had no idea what this was, and it took me a while to figure out how to pull it out of my foot, but yeah, that one stuck with.
What a memory, and I'm sure the pain is still in your memory, too.
A little bit.
Thank you so much.
I play with poppers occasionally, so, yeah.
Yeah, very cool. Thanks a lot, Bruce. I appreciate it. We also have Amelia on the line now. Amelia is calling from Montello. Thanks for calling, Amelia.
Hi.
Hi. What's your memory?
Well, I have a very happy first memory. I was about 3 years old, and this would have been in Deerfield, Illinois in the early 60s. And I remember I was in a old-fashioned two-aisle grocery store with my mom, and I was toddling along carrying a bag of puffy Cheetos that was as big as I was, and I couldn't have been happier.
I love it. Do you still eat Cheetos today?
Love them.
Your love started early, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was fun.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. I really appreciate it, Amelia. And the number to call, 800-642-1234. There's still plenty of time to share your memory with us. Let's go to Carl now. Carl is calling from Greendale. Hi, Carl.
Hi. A really interesting show. My earliest memory goes back to when I was just past one, maybe 15 months old. I live with my grandparents in the city of Milwaukee because my brother, who had just been born, was very sick, and he was in the hospital for 3 months. And I remember my grandfather teaching me how to talk, and he would stand by the window with me as I looked out, and people and objects would go by, and he would say things like dog, and I'd get, you know, that was a dog. And when my mom came back, finally got me after 3 months, she was amazed that I had a vocabulary of like 12 or 15 words, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the earliest memory. I can see everything. I can visualize all, but my memory's like that. Same with when I was two, many memories, three, like John F. Kennedy when he died. I remember that day when I was three. So lots of that kind of stuff. But that's what my earliest one I can remember is that one.
That's crazy. I mean, you're 1 year old, and I remember something from when I was like sitting in a crib when I was young, and my mom has always said, you can't remember anything that from that far back. What do you think about that? I mean, you're one.
Yeah, I know. I mean, my memory's always been like that. Very clear. I can recall memories I can see the visuals. I can even smell some of the smells, you know. I know that sounds odd, but I can't tell you that the day and the calendar things happen, but I remember that those days and those events. And, you know, even when I was in my twos, things that happened, like I lost my little toy gun down the wall. In fact, someday when I rip that house down, I'm going to look for that gun. Little plastic toy gun. It fell down the wall. And I was very upset because I couldn't reach it because my parents' house was under construction. But yeah, but that takes me back. That's the absolute earliest I can remember.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that with us. And I'm glad you said that thing about the smells, because I think that those are all part of our memory. I mean, the smells and the sights and the sounds, it's all part of it, don't you think?
So, you know, another interesting thing is how you remember things and you don't know the context. Like when Kennedy died, I remember that where I was and I was sitting and my mom had gotten this phone call and she was so upset. And, you know, and she tried to explain to me what happened, and it was kind of came out like your dad, the boss, died, right? And I didn't understand what that meant until years later, but I remember the day, and then I remember not being able to watch cartoons that Saturday because the funeral was on, and I was upset because I couldn't watch any cartoons.
So, sure.
I'm a selfish 3-year-old, you know?
Well, sure, that's what we think about when we're three, right? So, well, and again, thank you so much for calling. I've enjoyed talking with you, Carl.
Thanks for the opportunity to share.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Vivian is on the phone with us as well. We have Vivian calling from Green Bay. Hi, Vivian.
My earliest memory is looking out the window of a 2-story farmhouse at my siblings. There were 8 of us in the family. And I was always the last one to get up and go out. But we loved the sandbox. And then as Rob spoke with the author, I thought, why was I always the last one? And it's because I stayed up late in the quiet and created cutout clothes for my cardboard doll. And again, reflecting on Rob's conversation, 5 girls and my mom, and no one sewed. But really? I grew up and taught myself how to sew clothes for economy, and I reused fabrics and things. And it all goes back, I think, to staying up too late.
Probably. Oh, Vivian, thank you so much for sharing that story with us. I really appreciate it. Dean Canetter, our Central Time executive producer, weighed in, too. He said, maybe it's just me longing for the summer weather, but one of my first memories is playing in the sandbox in the backyard and eating oranges in the sun. He said he remembers being fascinated when he found out that you could dig far enough through the sand to hit dirt. And that's as far as his geology career went, but he still likes learning about the earth. At any rate, I want to thank all of our callers who shared a story with us today. That was great. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is once again choosing from a set of potential electoral maps in the state. We'll dig into what the different options before the court could mean for the balance of power in the legislature. That's on Central Time from 3 until 6. And on Food Friday, Wisconsin chef Dan Fox shares tips on braising meats and how we can make restaurant-quality food with just one pot and a stove, coming up tomorrow on Central Time.